Welcome to the Third Growth Option podcast, where we talk with business leaders and innovators hungry to drive growth that can be faster than internal organic growth and less risky than acquisition. Your moderator is Bernal Dunkerspuler, Chief Sherpa and CEO at Realign, who has led private equity-owned distributors through turnarounds and growth. With battle-proven leaders from all frontiers, we want to provoke thinking about business growth beyond conventional wisdom and binary choices.
Hey, I'm Benno, your host, talking today with Preet Brar, an executive leader, VP of brands and a brand strategist with a creative brand product, global experience. In the last dozen years, Preet moved up the executive ranks at Giftcraft, a major gift and fashion manufacturer. Preet, welcome to the Third Growth Option podcast.
Thank you, Benno. Thank you for having me.
I've really enjoyed the conversations that we've had over the last few months. You know, we work in, you know, the same industry and, you know, we knew of each other through LinkedIn and stuff. And I was like, God, you know, we could talk about business growth. We could talk about consumer topics, global sourcing, sustainability, leadership, mentorship, all kinds of different things. But I kind of wanted to have a frame up this conversation around the idea of how do you get from ideas, you know, from concept to reality, and kind of talk a little bit externally about the market, consumer, you know, the tea leaf reading that people like you and I do, and then talk a little bit in the second half internally around people and teams and, you know, leadership and that kind of stuff. But let's start externally. There's no point in talking about growth ideas and taking them to reality if we misread the market. And so we just finished home and gift trade show season, and I'm assuming you're in stores all the time and on, you know, cool brand websites all the time. What changes are you seeing in the consumer, sort of, you know, any changes post-COVID? We can finally call it post-COVID, can't we?
For sure. I would like to call it that. Post-COVID, you know, it's COVID is, first off, I like to remind myself that the world has changed and it's not the same. And it's no point trying to make ourselves believe that we're going to go back to 2019 or things are going to get normal or that is the normal. We need to start accepting that this is the new normal. This is the baseline. This is where we are starting from. The consumer is not the same. The market's not the same. You know, the supply chain's not the same. So this is the current that we're dealing with. And all our strategies and everything is going to be based on what's now and what is going to be next. I think that's just important for us to plan with that in mind rather than trying to figure out what we did in the past that worked.
Throw away the anchors and burn the boats, right?
Yeah.
What are you seeing? Like any impressions, anything struck you as you were walking trade shows, you know, where exhibitors, manufacturers are putting products that, you know, the consumer won't see until, you know, later in 2023?
First off, like just going walking into Atlanta, I just think, just going back after about 2 or 3 years, you kind of saw that same passion and excitement back in the retailers, at least coming back. You know, there was the surprise and delight of new product and connecting with the old industry friends, even waiting in elevators, you know, just trying to have those conversations and everybody trying to figure out with each one, how did they pivot? You know, what did they do to get by in the last 2 years and what's new for them? I do feel that there's a lot of cross-category buying that started to happen. A lot of the people that thought that they were in one category have started to experiment a lot with other categories and trying to see what would work for their consumer.
That's interesting. Why do you think that is?
I do feel like everybody had to kind of give up their conventional thinking and thought process and come up with something to adapt in the last 2 years.
That's exciting. That's exciting, isn't it?
It absolutely is. You know, one of the recent things that I was listening to where they talked about how to handle difficulty, right? How to get creative around it. I do feel that everybody was faced with a lot of difficulty in the last 2 years, and they've had to get creative. They've had to use that difficulty to their advantage. And that's one of the reasons why they started looking outside the box. And I think that's what's probably, it's accelerating people trying to experiment with new categories and new areas and new channels too. People who were just using retail or brick and mortar retail are trying online. The people who were just online are trying wholesale. You know, the wholesalers are trying to go direct to consumer themselves. So there's a lot of newness in just how people approach things.
I love that. You know, I heard the term the other day, work through the difficulty. And I think to me, that's, you know, sort of embracing the difficulty, embracing what's going on and moving forward. And I think in a way, all of us, I think the whole world in the last couple of years got hit over the head with a 2x4 and we got shaken out of, you know, the comfort zone of, you know, as you said, you know, well, we do these categories, we do these price points, we do, you know, here's how we do it. I mean, a lot of people's cheese got moved, to use that business book from, I don't know, 20 years ago. Where does sustainability and eco-friendly, you know, concerns for around sustainability and the eco-friendly product fit into that? I feel like it's been a buzzword we've been talking about for years, if not even decades, but nobody took it seriously. But now it is starting to gain momentum. How do you see that changing?
I definitely see a glimmer of hope there, you know, with, you know, what started as, you know, a little subsets of people, you know, talking about sustainability or planet or, you know, trying to do all of that stuff has now moved into the mass. You start seeing it where brands are taking notice of it. You know, the customers are expecting this from brands. And it's not a nice to have, but a need to have thing from brands now when they're working with their consumers. The demand is coming from consumers. The consumer is ready to make the change, but it's important for the brands and the product people to create the option of that change for the consumers. And I think once that connects, that's when it really kind of takes, it's going to create impact. You know, we all know what the right thing to do was. We all know that, you know, plastics are bad. We all know we need to use better things. We need to use more sustainable things. And not just in terms of raw material, you know, you're talking about sustainability in people too. You know, it's people, planet, product, everything together. So I do feel that, you know, the masses, like the idea from the masses is moving up and they're demanding it and the brands are taking a stand and they're really trying to work through this, that what is their sustainability statement? How are they accountable for this? And I think more and more it's going to go around transparency in product and brands. Like I always say, you know, I do all the right things. I use, you know, glass water bottles and not plastic, and I use my own grocery bags and different things. But maybe 90% of the other things that I do, I just don't have a more sustainable option that I can work with. So I think once that companies start to create that and that center stage, in the next probably 10 years, you're going to see a huge difference, not just from consumers and brands, but governments. It kind of goes back to, you know, obviously you have to create sustainable product. You have to make sure that it's traceable. And the biggest part of that also has to be the governance around it. You know, how companies or, you know, different countries are creating policies around sustainability. I just read about this in Copenhagen. There, one of their big fashion events, one of their required criteria was that your company has to be 50% sustainable, or you have to be using 50% sustainable in your product. So when that kind of stuff starts to happen, I just feel like people get more conscious and we'll see a change, a huge change.
A few years ago, and it was maybe pre-COVID, like I heard and read a lot about, you know, the sharing economy and, you know, that we're going to, you know, car sharing services as, you know, there was talk about people aren't going to buy a car anymore. They're just going to share cars and stuff like that, which, you know, obviously is a lot more efficient use of resources. I haven't really heard much about that in the last few years. Do you think that's a thing or will be in the future?
I do think, and I do keep going back to the fact that there has to be accountability, right? And once you start holding each other accountable for the decisions that you're making, you know, people start to, you know, it's almost like, you know, if people start judging people for using too much of their own car, right? They kind of get pushed to say, you know what, listen, you know, I don't have to do it separately. Let's just try and share it. Can we share something? Don't remember which part of the world it is, but they're trying to create this new, I don't remember. I have to check it up, but they're trying to create this city where everything is shared. Like one car is going to be shared by four households. It is one of the tests that they're trying to do. So it's I do feel the share economy is going to be an upwards trend.
Are there any opportunities, you know, in this consumer products industry around, you know, home decor and gifts and apparel? I don't think we're going to share pants. I'm thinking not, maybe, but do you think there are opportunities in home decor, home furnishings? Will people rent furniture instead of, you know, trade furniture and stuff like that? I mean, there are some, you know, secondhand furniture stores popping up.
Yeah, it's, you know what, Benno, I do see it. And, you know, once we talk about fashion, I know you don't reuse the pants or you wear somebody else's pants, but the model of renting has been there for about the last, I would say, 7 to 10 years already, with companies like Rent the Runway, you know, where people are not spending too much on luxury products, but they're renting. And also you have the secondhand one, right? Like you've got all these companies where you're reusing a lot of the stuff. I definitely see that home decor has an opportunity to do something similar because that stuff doesn't go away, right? It can keep getting refurbished and reused. Again, it goes back to, are there platforms that are going to facilitate for that to happen, right? The consumer is ready. The consumer is open. It's about somebody coming up with a platform and creating that with ease for them to start using it. You've got stuff like, you know, when Uber came in and different things, and you have all of these cooking, a lot of cooking apps and different things where people are, you know, they're adopting a lot of these new ways of sharing and working. I think the consumer is really open to trying something like this if it was to be made available in an easy manner.
Right. And then the next question that executives always ask, and rightfully so, as you know, well, where is the consumer insight on that? Where is the proof, you know, that if we spend, you know, time and energy and resources on building that platform, that they will come, right? And the difficulty with that is, to some extent, the, you know, the old Henry Ford adage, if I had asked them what kind of car they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. So I think it's, there is a lot of tea leaf reading going on for people like you who, you know, head up brands and product development and, you know, that whole creative process to get ideas, you know, from concept to reality and figure out which concepts to take to reality and which concepts to, you know, let them germinate a couple more years before we invest energy.
You're absolutely right, right? Like, again, it kind of depends on, it's for the long term, you want to gain something long term, you have to give up a little bit of short term. You have to experiment, you have to try. And there will always be people who would be ready to try a lot more than the others. And there will be some who will be waiting to see, like you said, a proof of concept to see, is this something that's really going to work? So it just depends which one are you and what percentage of your business you're going to try and test.
Right, right. So speaking of platforms, you know, the obvious one, the obvious big question in you know, in terms of the marketplace and consumer trends is brick and mortar stores or online. So we've seen, you know, a continuous growth over the last 20 years, you know, where pre-COVID, I think we were, average consumer dollars was somewhere around 20, 25%, 30% in some categories, much higher in other categories, zero in others. But the average is around plus or minus 25% of consumer dollars are being spent online. That spiked in the last couple of years, you know, when stores were closed during COVID, then it sort of dipped again. Some people are still talking about, you know, it'll be 50-50 between, you know, consumer dollars spent online versus consumer dollars spent in stores. What does your crystal ball tell you, you know, over the next, I don't know, 5 years or so?
I feel, Benno, the consumer is very smart. The consumer is going to pick what works for them. And it's going to be defined by their lifestyle choices and the lifestyle, you know, the whole work from home process, you know, how is that going to work out? What are their lives like? A lot of people would buy online because they don't have time to go out into the stores. It's just easier for them to buy online and they can shop that way. Whereas you have other people who have the time, they do enjoy the in-store experience, the more tactile. I think it's going to be a mix of both. The spike that we did see in the last 2 years, I feel, is going to right-size itself. Are we going to go back to a lot of people going just in store? Probably not. But again, it's going to be a balance. I do see that people, of course, right, there's learning, a lot of learning through COVID and like how people, just as brands are trying to go omni-channel, because that's what the consumer does, right? The consumer's not biased towards any one channel per se. You know, I give it an example of when, you know, so you get into the shower and you've got the hot and the cold. And everybody kind of goes in and, you know, you adjust it perfectly to like where you like it. So I feel that's depending on where you are in your life, how much time you have and what your buying behavior is. It's going to dictate your shopping habits.
Right, right. My gut instinct is that shopping online is going to get easier and easier. The technology, you know, it continues to improve. And I think it's going to be pretty close to a, you know, 40-60, 50-50 kind of split by the end of this decade.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with you that.
You could call me 5 or 10 years from now and say, well, I was wrong, but that's how I'm seeing. I don't know.
No, but you're right, Ben. Like, the more seamless the technology gets, the easier it gets for people to adopt it, right? It's going to go hand in hand with technology and people's lifestyles, the consumer choices.
You've given a lot of great insights and, you know, thoughts around sort of the market and the consumer, you know, looking outside into the marketplace. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, internal, you know, none of these external ideas mean anything if we don't have people and teams getting products from, you know, the back of a napkin to a shippable thing. So how do you get your own team members and, you know, maybe even including folks in more operational roles, which are typically the more operational, the more routine is important, efficiency is important, and the less comfortable they are with, you know, embracing the new, embracing the, hey, we never tried this, let's try that. You know, operations people are not super excited about that. So how do you get your own team members, whether it's, you know, the creative people or the operations people, to embrace new?
Yeah. So, Benno, I've been fortunate enough to have worked on different continents and with a lot of different companies, big and small size. So I do have learnings from a lot of different environments, cultures, how people behave, how people work. And I do feel that I'm still learning. You learn every day. But a couple of things that stand out for me when you're working with a team. Again, I work with more of the creative teams, but it can apply to any team, really. And more so for smaller to midterm companies I'm talking about, right? Like, these are companies where the owners are probably really involved, or, you know, the founders are very involved, and it's just starting. Communication, to me, is the most important part. Your teams are, you know, if you thought of teams as kids, you know, you really need to answer two basic questions for them. Where are we going and how are we going to get there? If you go back and you talk about the vision behind it, who are we? You know, what do we stand for? These might seem like they're kind of like these academic things that you want to talk about. But really, if you go back to it, this is what's important for your team to understand. Everybody on your team needs to know what success looks like and where are they contributing? What part are they contributing and they're responsible for? So it's almost like taking that vision or the thought that you have or the path that you're looking at, creating it bite-size and sharing it with your team and each team member. I read something very interesting recently, and they said a vision, or, you know, where you're going, the mission of your company, it needs to be internalized by your team. And it doesn't happen until your team starts to make jokes about how often you repeat it.
Right. That's when you know you're successful, when they're making fun of you.
Yeah, yeah. But at that point, you realize that they've all kind of imbibed it. They understand, right? They've internalized it, that this is who we are. This is what we want to do. This is where we're going. This is what we got to do. And that creates an environment of belonging and understanding. And it builds trust, right? So I think communication of your vision and where you're going and what you're doing and how are you going to get there is extremely important, not just for the top level, but to the last, you know, like every single person on the team. Because it's a chain, right?
I love the way you started out with communication, which is, you know, almost a bumper sticker, like, yeah, okay, we all know we need to communicate better, and we all know we don't do a good enough a job, right? But then you took it to, you know, really where the rubber meets the road on communication. I think you're absolutely right, is about articulating what success looks like in a way that people can internalize it and, you know, buy into it and, you know, and maybe push back on it. And what if we you know, change, you know, maybe do some wordsmithing on that. And that's great. And that's exactly what you want, right? You want smart people to push against, you know, ideas for them to really buy into it. I think that's just part of the process, isn't it?
Yeah. And like you just said, the word process, right? That I feel also is a very underestimated kind of word in smaller companies. The more entrepreneurial and you kind of get to things and you just kind of do them. And I feel like it poses challenges when you're trying to scale something, right? So kind of going back to communication, again, communication is important. So let's say you've told your team what you're looking for and this is what they need to do and you've broken it down into bite size. I do feel that creating or setting priorities for your team are very important too. Again, you know how people say if you have any more than 3 priorities, you don't have any. Just breaking it down to say where you start, and almost all these priorities have to line up in a perfect trajectory for you to execute what you're planning. Any miscalculations here is going to throw it off course. And obviously, you know, like there are things you need to adapt and things go wrong, but really it's process and planning, which is extremely important. And expectations too, right? Like, you know, they say sometimes you overestimate what you can do in a day, but underestimate what you can do in a year.
Yeah, I love that. That is so true. We all make that mistake, right? We all think we can do, you know, we could fit 10 pounds of stuff into a 5-pound bag, you know, short term, today or this year. And we don't think we can triple the size of our company in the next 5 or 10 years. We don't think that's possible, but it is.
It definitely is. But really kind of, again, going back to that bite size, you know, take communicating down to every level. And like, that's what execution is. You know, everybody can have an idea, but again, the key is execution.
You made a comment a couple months ago that really resonated with me. And I want you to talk a little bit about, you said, if you're indispensable, you're not a leader. How do you make yourself dispensable?
You know, it's again, first off, I think you need to, if you have an insatiable desire to learn and grow and transform, you will always make yourself dispensable from one place to move to the other. And I do feel that when you don't have that, you almost want to hold on to that one place. And you want to be that indispensable person that without whom nothing's going to happen. So I feel like being dispensable to me is freedom, right? To kind of work on something, learn, and then move on and learn more, and then move on and learn more and transform and enjoy that process. I think that's important. And kind of going back to that too, Benno, I feel mentorship, you know, to coach and being coachable is extremely important too. Right? I don't think...
Both, right?
Yeah, both. Absolutely. Yeah.
You're right.
It is. And, you know, and I feel like people kind of think, oh, to be a mentor, you have to have this 20 or 25 years behind you. And, you know, you need to know all of this stuff. I feel like even if I have 1 year over somebody else, I have learned something more than this person coming in knows.
I was just thinking about my 23-year-old daughter, right? Who works in the business with me and helps me. And I have to learn because she's no longer 5, right? I was a certain kind of mentor when she was 5. Now she's 23. And I have to learn that she knows stuff that I don't know, which is why I sort of went, you know, a light bulb went off when you said mentorship goes both ways. We have to coach and be coachable. And then you said you don't have to have 25 years more experience, even 1 year. And I would say even the opposite. Like I have more than 25 years more experience than my daughter, but she knows stuff I don't know, and she can teach me stuff I don't know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it kind of goes there too, as, and we have to build this culture of mentorship, you know, wherever we're working, because what happens is you need leaders to create future leaders, and you need people to impart the knowledge, you know, there's knowledge sharing. And I feel there's succession planning, especially in smaller companies as they try to scale. And that knowledge has to transfer. And if there's a culture of sharing the knowledge with somebody else, I just feel like this is something that should be inbuilt within a company. You have to mentor someone, and you are being mentored by someone. So it just creates a really good bond of trust through the entire organization too. And people do feel very invested.
You know, it's interesting. I think this importance of building trust and sharing and mutual mentorship or you know, two-way mentorship is these are important concepts for how any team, you know, whether it's a small mid-sized company or a billion-dollar publicly traded company, is working differently today from 20, 40 years ago. You know, I think it's much more important today to have this sort of, you know, energy flowing between departments, within departments, between, you know, the more senior folks and the more junior folks, and the whole, you know, work from home hybrid thing that's, you know, going to stick around at various degrees, I think, from now going forward, really puts emphasis on creating an environment where energy is flowing, whether you're sitting next to each other, you know, or 5,000 miles apart, just talking on a Zoom call.
Absolutely.
And you guys you're working with people all around North America and globally, right? How do you get people engaged and involved, right, remotely? By doing all the things that you just said, right?
You're absolutely right, right? Like, again, it kind of comes back to conversations, right? How intentional the conversations are when you're having them with the team. And that team could be anywhere. The team could be globally anywhere, you know, and you have to invest in people. Where do they want to go? You know, what they're good at. And I think as a leader, one of the big things is you want to help people identify their strengths and kind of see it for themselves, what they're good at, and kind of build on that. And I feel, for me, I feel most fulfilled when I see somebody who didn't know they were really strong in a certain area, but they were, you know, to kind of really coming and embracing that strength of theirs and building on it.
The last question I had for you for this episode was, you know, what do you wish you had known 20 years ago that you know now? And I'm going to answer it for me. It is exactly what you just said. I wish I had known decades earlier that I have to embrace my superpowers and I have to help others embrace their superpowers, and that focusing on, you know, what is my unique gift, what is your unique gift, their unique gift, that is kind of where the magic happens for me. How would you answer the question of what you wish you had known in your early 30s that you know today?
You know, I do feel the whole mentoring part too. I feel like very early on in your career, it's all about me, 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 because that's, you're kind of in that hustle culture and everything is about, you know, you're growing, you're kind of growing faster, higher, you know, you're ambitious. And I wish that there was an inbuilt culture where it's not just me, 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 but it's, you know, you're taking people with you, right? There are others along the way that you've lifted and you worked with. I've seen that happen in the past 10 years in my career, in which I feel is like that's what changed my thought process. And you get to a point where you do feel that you have things that you've learned that you want to share and you want to work with others. Another one thing that I did learn now after 25 years, Benno, which I'm sure a lot of people in the same situation as me would kind of think of, is that you need to know that it's okay to slow down. I think that part, nobody teaches you, nobody tells you, and you only realize it when you're kind of at the end of it and you go, you know, you've overplayed all your strengths, you know, you didn't take time to breathe, you didn't take time to kind of recalibrate and kind of just sit back and say, you know what, it's okay, I'm just going to slow down a little bit until I accelerate again. So that's the part I wish I knew a little bit earlier than now.
I didn't learn that until, you know, fairly recently that, you know, if I take some time for myself or for my family and not work, you know, it's so much better all the way around, because not only, you know, for myself or for my family, but when I go back to work, I'm fully charged in a way I was only half charged in my 30s, right? I was working on a half a battery charge because I worked 80 hours a week.
We all do that, right? Like we just, it's, again, it's that whole, you know, you're passionate about something and you have purpose. And you kind of learn it late that, you know, to be able to fuel that passion and purpose, you need the bandwidth and the energy to kind of see it through.
As a friend of mine said, Benno, we're human beings, not human doings.
Yes.
Remember, you don't need to do stuff all the time. Anyway, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for taking time and sharing your thoughts on the original topic. Was how do you nurture growth, you know, get ideas from concept to reality. But I think you've helped shine a light on, you know, various angles of that topic. So thank you so much, Preet.
Thanks, Manu. Thank you and congratulations on putting together this amazing podcast. I've heard a lot of interesting conversations, you know, over the past year, and just love sharing ideas. So thank you.
If folks wanted to reach out to you, they can find you on LinkedIn. Is that probably the best place?
Yes. Yeah. LinkedIn would be it.
I'm just going to spell your name for everybody. Preet. Preet Brar. Brar.
Yes.
We got it. Thank you, Preet. Thank you.
Thanks, Manu. Thanks.
Hey, if folks wanted to explore other growth topics, you can find me on our website, realignforresults.com, or just email Benno, B-E-N-N-O, at realignforresults.com. Thanks, and keep growing.
You can listen to more episodes on Apple, Spotify, or Google. We would love for you to subscribe, rate, and review it. Share it with your friends or colleagues if you enjoyed the content. Always growing.